Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Encore.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Hey, there you go. We had a doubleheader tonight. Hello, This is Joseph G with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which I had mentioned before, and I think I'm going to mention again that science have discovered a parallel universe, a completely new, unique, and different universe. I was so excited when I heard the news, I went out immediately and applied for the position of center. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. Anytime I'm in a meeting of recovery and there's a newcomer, we have a tendency to tell the new person that they're the most important person in the room. And I'll hear that several times, or she, several times during the meeting. And if I get a chance to chime in, I'll usually say, you know, you're the most important person in the room besides me, or unless the room catches fire. And then it's every man for himself, and sometimes that's the way it works in sobriety. I have to make sure that I'm sober before I can help you get sober. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. And they do it at a very good price. They do it for us for free, which is, you can't beat that. We've negotiated free. We have that little money. We had to negotiate free. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. We had one several months ago about the fourth step. They do every so often. They'll post something that we send in, and so as an acknowledgement, and it's a good magazine. It's an internet magazine, and it gives you some good insights. It's a good thing to look to in between meetings, in between reading your basic doctrine, your basic text. So this way, it keeps you always engaged in elevating your recovery platform. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist and does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, and basically so does the world. What we have found is that most of the problems today we have with drugs and alcohol come from the breakdown of the family unit. Children were not taught or not being taught correct principles. Once a child is taught correct principles, they can teach themselves because now they have a foundation. But without that fundamental foundation of understanding morality and common sense, you'd be kind of surprised. Common sense isn't as common as you might think. So the kids are out there, latchkey kids was the term growing up, and then they're like empty lot weeds. They grow up, mean streets, clubs, gangs, groups, and of course it's drugs, sex, and rock and roll, which works for me for a very long time. And he also goes to the prison. So we have this dysfunctional families and drugs are the peer group acceptance rite of passage. And then now we have the prisons. Harold goes to the prisons. And in the prisons we find, and the statistics had come out, we did it in one of the shows, 80% of everyone in the prisons, that's a huge number, is there because of related to alcohol and drug-related crimes. 80%. You know what a drain that is on the families involved with that and on the economy as a whole? It's huge. See, it's epidemic proportion, and it doesn't seem like it's abating anytime soon. So here at Rum Radio, we do the best we can trying to get out the good news that there is a solution to drugs and alcohol addiction. But there's a caveat. Well, actually, there's two caveats. One is you got to take an action. Scriptures say we turn towards God, and then he turns towards us. So if one good turn deserves another. The other is the answer, the people in the rooms have the answer. But these are the people are from State Penn, Penn State, just recently released from the insane asylums, the prisons. We have all kinds, airline pilots. We have doctors. The guy that just came off the street from Skid Row. Recovery rooms are so inclusive, we even allow attorneys in there. I know. It's beyond imagine, but they're welcome too, as long as they have a desire to do something about their addiction. They're welcome in the rooms anytime. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've found over my 26 years that the rooms of recovery are like fruit orchards, and we come in at first and we pick the fruit and we're nourished, and then it's necessary to take care of the orchard and so that it will be there for the new guy that comes along behind us. What I've found is that working the steps myself with a sponsor then prepares me to help the new guy work the steps. And it's working the steps that really made the big difference in my life and saved my life. So I consider it an honor to be here and be on the program and be in recovery. Each day of my 9,000-something days is a gift from God. And my first sponsor told me that drinking and drugging is a search for God at the wrong address. So I really give thanks to God for every day of my recovery and for saving my life. And this is my way of giving back. Also, I'd like our listeners to know that this is Joseph's way of giving back. He doesn't make a penny off of the radio program or the website. In fact, quite the opposite. It costs thousands to maintain a website like this. It's quite detailed. There's a lot of great information on the website. We go right to the book and we go back to basic so that we can do it the way they used to do it in 1935. They had a much better success rate back then. Some changes have slowly, gradually crept in, and we want to go back to basics and make that happen. So Joseph spent a lot of money, and I appreciate that, and it's his way of giving back and also mine. We have a great guest tonight. Oh, let me give the call-in number if you'd like to call in, be part of the program. It's 949-534-0621. That's 949-534-0621. And let me turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. That's very nice of you. Very humbling to say that, but that's enough about me. Would someone else like to talk about me? Today we're coming across the 4th of July. Yay, the 4th of July. That's the day we celebrate the founding of our nation. Wow, what a great place to be, huh? A lot of people don't realize that we're still the torchbearer of freedom in the world. So I wrote this I was trying to get him to put it on the handout pamphlet at my church, but one guy promised me he was going to do it. I was all excited. I went today, and it wasn't there. I can't catch a break with some of these guys. But this is what it is. It's a little something. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. For this is the day the Lord has made to honor our banner of freedom and our kindred fallen dead. Rights and choices we hold so dear is a decree to the world we would make clear. We pray to the God of our fathers in the highest esteem, and these truths we will not rest, for in liberty we do confess, and in his hand we will not perish from the scene. So have a happy 4th of July, and try to remember the reason why we're doing it. Now, this is the greatest, still the greatest country on the earth. I know we go out to the world, and everybody's got their own little shtick with Brazil and Japan, and all, everybody else has a nationalistic spirit, and that's what causes wars. But America is still the beacon of freedom. Make no mistake about that. The world, as much as they hate it, they still look towards us as that beacon. And we remain that beacon in the world of choice, which is God's plan for man on the earth today. Before I get started, we have a special guest, I always just say guest host, I'm the host. We have a special guest tonight. I only say special guest on Sunday nights. It's the only time we do the live show. Dan Forkel, are you there, Dan?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. So if you just hang in for a little bit, we're going to read How It Works from Chapter 5. Oh, by the way, we're not AA. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. We're not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where to hold the meetings. And if you've been a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous, just consider the website a wake-up call, a call into action. I believe we're saved by grace after all that we can do, not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA and the other sister 12 steps is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. So we go into action. If otherwise, it goes like this. A body in motion tends to stay in motion, while a body at rest tends to get drunk. Stay in motion. I'd like to read from Chapter 5, and this, in most meetings of AA anyway, they'll read this in the beginning. And this is how it works. So people who come in, they'll get an idea of what the new guy, the new man, everything we do is to benefit the guy walking through the door or the guy we just brought into the meeting so he knows what's going on. And this is how it works from Chapter 5. It's page 58. I have the third edition. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you decided you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then they're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. That just seems to come out of nowhere about 5-6 years ago. Now everybody seems to do it in this neck of the woods in any event. So, Dan, now it's up. You're up at bat. I'm going to throw you a fastball. Well, you know, we're going to do what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now, and then what keeps you into maximum service to God and your fellow beings. So tell us, when was the first time you did your drug or you did your alcohol and the angels sang and the bells start to ring and you go, hey, something's up with, what's up with that?
Well, let me digress a little before we get into that, Joseph.
Sure.
First, I want to thank you and Harold for inviting me tonight. I consider it a privilege anytime I get people who are interested in learning about recovery. So I applaud the job that the two of you are doing. It's a much needed service, you know, especially for those who can't get out to a meeting. I appeared on a telephone meeting a couple of weeks ago. That's the first time I ever did that. And I'm learning all these new avenues that are out there of communication to other alcoholics that didn't heretofore exist. I think it's a wonderful, the technological advancements, because, I mean, when I got sober, we didn't have computers or cell phones or anything else. You had a landline and pay phones, and that was about it. Let me say, first of all, my name is Dan, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's probably the most important thing I can say today, because that kind of centers me and lets me you know, realize who and what I am and what I have to do. And I can regale you with stories of and drunkologues and car chases and guns and knives and pipes and jail cells and all that other stuff, and we'll touch on that. But I think the way I identified mostly with people, especially when I was new, and I think the way people will still identify today is, what's it feel like to be an alcoholic? You know, And I felt like an alcoholic long before I picked up my first drink, not knowing that that's what I was. Now, I come from a long line of my family were all alcoholics, not only immediate family but extended family, and there's nobody I know that I've ever met in my family that couldn't avail themselves of a seat in the room. And as a kid, as a baby, you know, my first memories of being in bars, you know, taking sips of people's drinks. So you asked me when I had my first drink. I was probably 6 months old. But no real recollection of that, you know. And when we go to the bars, you know, I was a poor Irish kid born in the Bronx and to a sea of alcohol. You'd be amazed how many stories started like that 30 years ago. And by the way,
you know, I wasn't sure your last name with it, but I was going to say, are you Irish?
Yeah. Irish.
Okay, well that answers a lot right there.
But in the meantime, I don't care how long you've been in Texas, you're never going to get away from that Brooklyn accent you got.
No. But you know what it is? I'm not smart enough. You can take the boy out of the city, but you can't take the city out of the boy.
I got you. Anyway, so I grew up, you know, the bartender was my godfather, you know, all the people in the bar were my relatives, and I just thought this is, you know, the way life should be. And none of that, I believe, had anything to do with me being an alcoholic. What it did do was influence the way I drank and where I drank and the role models I had growing up. But, you know, I was destined to be an alcoholic from the day I was born, I believe. Firmly in my heart, it's genetic. It's not 100% genetic, but it's predominantly genetic. And I'll tell you a story later that'll reinforce that point. But I walked around, you know, an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I felt everybody else had been given the manual for life. And I didn't even have the table of contents. You know, I just couldn't,
yeah,
I couldn't
like
figure it out. Everybody seemed to have it all together, and I didn't. I was too afraid to ask anybody. And that fear was my constant companion, fear of people, fear of places, fear of things. And none of it was grounded. It was just that unnamed fear that seemed to, you know, be within me from my earliest recollections. I always had that fear. And it was guilt and shame and remorse. And for what reason, I don't know. But those are the feelings that I had. And then I picked up my first drink, and it all went away. It was like magic.
Yes.
I felt like I was a part of. I felt like I was equal to. I could sing. Well, when I had my first drink, my first real drink, I was 8 years old. And what had happened then, my father died of alcoholism when he was 32. And
wow.
I was the oldest of four children, and I was eight. And I had two younger brothers and a younger sister. And my mother was left with the four of us. And so that summer, I went away to a YMCA day camp, and all the 8 and 9 year old slots were filled up, and I was in with the 14 and 15 year olds and hung out with them after camp. And I'd be standing up on the corner, US 1 in New Rochelle, pack of Camels rolled up in my sleeve, Santa Schaefer in my hand, singing doo-wop on the corner, thinking that I had arrived, thinking this is the coolest thing in the world. I didn't start drinking alcoholically until I was probably 14 and continued on for another 20 years doing that. And you know, that I would always chase that magic that came the first drunk or just the first couple of drunks. And the magic never came back, but I kept changing. I kept chasing it, and I had to drink eventually. By the time I was in high school, I was not a daily drinker, you know, but I was Thursday through Monday mostly. I had a bottle in my locker, and I would take sips between classes just to get me through the day. At the same time, there was a huge dichotomy in my life, as there were in a lot of alcoholics. You know, I was very popular. I was athletic. I was a good scholar. I was the president of the class, captain of the football team, you know, and at the same time, I was the leader of the gang. And I could, you know, be stealing hubcaps at night and presiding over student government office during the daytime. The one constant amongst all those things was so that there was had to be alcohol involved. No matter where I was, what I did, there had to be alcohol involved. But I was basically a chameleon, and I wanted to be whoever I thought you wanted me to be. You know, I could be a jock, I could be a nerd, I could be a greaser, and I could be all those things on the same day. Because if you knew who I really was, you wouldn't like me. So I had to pretend to be what you thought I should be. And that's very tiring. And nobody really got to know me. But I had a lot of friends, but it was all on the surface. And I wanted to keep everybody at arm's length because I really didn't want you to know the real me. Because I hated me. I didn't know I hated me. But I knew you would hate me if you knew me. When I was 15 years old, this was when back in New York, 18 was the legal age to drink, but if you had some phony proof, there were, you know, tons of bars that would let you in. And we went to this old dive in Nerichel, the Grandview Tavern. Me and two of my buddies were all 15. And it was one of these dark, you know, sort of bars with nothing but drunks in it.
And, smells and of we urine?
Yeah, well, that
smells
too.
Of stale
that
beer
too.
And urine.
That, yeah, that too.
And, you don't want to be there during the day. Anybody who was there during the day, if the door opened and the light came in, it was like a rush.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
People would look, they would see each other because they really couldn't see each other in the dim. As soon as the door would open and for a flash of a second, they could see each other and then it would get dark again.
Well, and when we were, it was dark, but the three of us were sitting at the bar drinking our 15-cent beers. And there's an old guy at the end of the bar with the classic alcoholic position. His head is down, his arms are crossed, and he's passed out on the bar, empty shot glass, empty beer glass in front of him. And my friends started making fun of the guy. And I didn't. I didn't, because even then I knew, and again, I didn't notice consciously, but even then I knew he had what I wanted, and that was complete oblivion. Complete escape. Mm. I wanted to get away from myself, but the problem was everywhere I went, there I was. And if I drank enough, I could get to that state of oblivion, and I could be free of me. And that, you know, I was never, ever comfortable in my own skin. I was never, ever happy with who I was. And who I was wasn't all that bad. It was just my perception. All my life, I looked at myself and those around me through the distorted lens of self-centeredness. And when I looked at myself, the picture I saw was ugly and was hateful. And I never could like me. Anyway, you know, I didn't get into trouble every time I got drunk, but every time I was in trouble, I had been drunk. And just to give you an example of that, you know, when I was in high school, I went to a party, and I got ready for that party like I got ready for everything. I had a gallon of wine before I left to the party. And that was the last thing I remember. I went to the party, drank some more. And the next morning, my mother wakes me up. Two detectives at the front door. They take me downtown to question me. I had, you know, and they said that there was an eyewitness who saw me leaving the window of a woman who had been raped the night before. The night
oh,
of the party,
man.
Right in the vicinity of the party, and I was identified as the guy that was leaving the window. And I didn't remember. You know, I was a blackout drinker from day one, and I just didn't remember. And I denied it, but I didn't know. And they brought me back down again the following week and questioned me again for hours. And I didn't know, and I kept saying, I don't. But the more I thought about it, I said, gee, I could have done this. I could have done this. The following week, they caught the guy who did it. He got convicted and sent away. Nobody ever called me to apologize. Nobody ever said, sorry, we were wrong. But it just goes to show you, you know, I could have been doing 5 to 10 to something I never did because of my drinking.
And they want to know for sure whether you were guilty or not.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Because everybody in there is innocent anyway. You would have just fit right in.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I yeah, you mentioned in your little your blurbs about the 200 barroom fights, and I'll just touch on that for a second because that's a real number. I used to get in fights all the time, and what would happen is I would let things build up, and they would explode, and at least once a month, probably twice a month, I would get in a real bad fight. And
I think the term is a Donnybrook. It's a Donnybrook, right?
And, this was before everybody carried guns and knives and machine guns. So we usually did it with fists and bottles and bricks. When I got sober, I tried to count up the number of barroom fights. I stopped when I got to 200. I figured that was enough. And it's a remarkable number for two reasons. Number one, I never thought I started one of those fights.
Oh.
I thought people just didn't understand my sense of humor. The problem was I hated myself so much I could tear you apart with my tongue. And if I did that when I was sober, you didn't know what I was doing. You just knew you felt like garbage when I got finished with it. But when I did it when I was drunk, you knew what I was doing and you didn't like it. And you usually take a swing at me.
Sarcasm.
But the second reason,
the definition of sarcasm is cutting flesh.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Sarcasm. So you would be cutting flesh, and of course the other people don't like that because you were, you had your wit about you, and so but you would turn it into a sarcasm. You're cutting these people up, and they didn't like it.
Oh, when I was drunk, I was doing it with a dull blade. That was the problem. They knew exactly what I was doing. But the second reason that those 200 fights are remarkable is because I never won one. I'm going to tell you right now that there were 199 of the toughest guys I've ever met, and that one woman, she was really hard.
And she was very short, too. I remember she was short.
Yeah,
she was a little woman at the time.
Oh, yeah, but you know what? You would think somebody with any common sense at all, after they go 0-100, would say there's no future in this. But I didn't. I kept going. I was persistent. Anyway, let's get back. I had a full ride to college, a scholarship. I started off on the dean's list. And by the end of my tenure there, I barely graduated. It took me an extra year. If it had gone on another 6 months, I would have funked that. That's how fast the progression was. You know, I was able to marshal my resources from time to time, but the downward progression was always there. Every time I would make a comeback, I wouldn't get up quite as high as I had been the time before, and I would sink a little lower on the downslide than I did before. And that just kept going. So I graduated college, degree in accounting. I'm working for one of the big eight accounting firms at the time. And in my mind, I'm God's gift to the business world. And as time went on, in a relatively short period of time, I started working for smaller firms for less money, for shorter periods of time, with longer periods of unemployment in there. During that period of time in 1976, my sister Darren, the most beautiful girl in the world, died of a drug overdose, 21 years old, put the wrong shit in her arm. My answer to that was to get a gun and go to the projects and look for her dealer. You know, lucky for both of us that I didn't find him that night. But, you know, that's my rational response to a tragedy. Showed up at the funeral, I was dead drunk. I was a complete distraction. I was disgusting and I was useless to no support to anybody around me. And that's what alcohol did to me. You know, it just it made me a drain on society. Is basically what was happening to me. I went to my first meeting in 1978, and there's a funny story there.
Let's back up. Now, something got you to the meeting. Now, we usually call it moment of clarity, jumping off place.
No. It was none of that. I'm going to tell you how I got to the first meeting.
Okay.
My youngest brother Brian and I are standing on the corner downtown New Rochelle, and we're passing back and forth a bottle of wine and a brown paper bag, you know, and we're getting ready to walk over to the Irish Center, which was a derelict bar right there back then, and just before we're getting ready to cross the street. Who comes rolling down the street but Dugan in a brand new Riviera with two beautiful girls in the front seat with him. Now Dugan was a stone cold alky. And I knew that because he would pass out in Nick's pool room 5 minutes before I did. And if you talk to Dugan today, he would tell you the same thing about me. But I'm looking at this guy. And I'm drinking wine out of a paper bag, and he's driving a brand-new car with two beautiful women. And I said to my brother Brian, who was a good friend of Dugan, I said, what happened to Dugan? And my brother said, AA. So I turned to my brother and said, let's go to a meeting. So I wanted what Dugan had. You know, it's a program of attraction.
Right.
and we literally called up Dugan that night, and we went to a meeting together. And it was him and my brother, and it was Stevie S., who was a guy I went to high school with, and little Danny from Port Chester, who was the power of example in that group with about a year and a half of sobriety. And we went to meetings, and I stayed sober for about 30 days, which was the longest period of time I had stayed sober since I was 14 years old. And at this point, I was 30. I was 29. And then decided that, you know, I wasn't powerless, you know, and I was going to find a way to do it my way. I was going to be able to drink the way I thought I should be entitled to drink without suffering the consequences. I was going to go over it, under it, around it, through it, you know, but I was going to find a way. And I kept trying and trying and trying. I kept going to meetings. But I was drinking a lot more than I was going to meetings. And during that, it took me 5 years, another 5 years, before I had my last drink. And during those 5 years, I got a couple more DUIs. I already had one, so I got three in total. Spent some more nights in jail than I care to remember. Was hospitalized more than I care to remember. Went through unemployment, kept losing jobs. Went through welfare. I got on welfare. I was getting food stamps. I was selling those for 50 cents on the dollar so I could buy a bottle. Eventually, I got evicted from my apartment. I was homeless. I was sleeping on the streets, sleeping in parked cars, sleeping on stairwells, wherever I could find a place. Sometimes I didn't find a place. I woke up in alleyways. That was my life. College-educated professional, now I'm a homeless bum, you know.
Wow.
Never, and just thinking to myself, you know, this is just temporary. Don't worry about it. You know, I never really thought of myself as homeless. I thought of myself as, you know, between apartments.
Have you ever heard this? It was two alcoholics underneath an overpass, and one of them was complaining. He says, you know, I used to be somebody. So I was a professional. I had a beautiful wife, the car, the home. I had it all. And now I'm living in a Lady Kenmore refrigerator cardboard box. And the other alcoholic goes, wow, you got a box?
Exactly.
Two
things happened during that period of time that I want to circle back to later. But the first one was I woke up in an alleyway, and I looked down, And my brown paper bag that was laying next to me was stained on the bottom. The whole bottom of it was stained because evidently when I fell, I broke the bottle and all the wine came out of it. And I sat there and I cried. And I cried because I wanted another bottle of wine and I didn't have a dollar to buy it. And there was that sense of desperation that I'll never forget. The second thing that happened, I think it was the same week, it might have been a week later. I remember being escorted out of a bar on US 1 in Mamaroneck. One guy on each arm dragging me out of the bar. They threw me in the gutter. Third guy comes walking out of the bar, leans over me, spits on me, calls me a worthless piece of shit. And I couldn't do anything. You know, I used to fight at the drop of a hat. I couldn't do anything because I felt he was right. That's what I felt like. I felt like garbage. And it was just, I didn't care about anything. And I didn't even have the gumption to get up and I just laid there in the gutter, you know. So, you know, during those, I also went to a rehab back then, you know, so I had 28 days sober, which was the second longest period of time I had since I was 14.
So this is your bottom now. This is the guy throwing you out in the gutter. Oh, not.
No.
Okay.
One of the tougher alcoholics.
Yeah, okay.
We're getting close, though, Joe. We're getting close.
People who are not in the program, I go by Joseph. If people in the program do not get this, they can't imagine.
I know.
This is like we're talking about the dark side of the moon. They go, he still didn't get it. What's it going to take?
And let me tell you, some
die and don't get it.
Well, we'll hear about that too. But you know, right now I'm getting close. So. When I hit my bottom, the homeless period was 79. When I hit my bottom, it was in 1983. And again, I had been going to meetings, but I had also been drinking a lot more than I'm going to meetings. I'm trying to control my drink, and I'm trying to, you know. And at that point in time, I had the best job I ever had in my life. I had an office on Park Avenue. I had some money in the bank, and I was engaged to a beautiful woman. And I had everything in the world that I ever wanted, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I had always said up to that point in time that if I had a good enough reason to quit, I could. Now I did, and I couldn't. And my last drunk wasn't too much like thousands that had preceded it. I was on a five-day bender, and at the end of the 5 days, it was a Tuesday morning, I was sitting down at Mariner's Inn in Mariner's, New York, drinking shots and beers, trying to keep my hands from shaking so I could call up work to see if I still had a job. And I looked in the mirror, and my face was red, and it was bloated, and I was sweating. It was April. And I said, what the hell are you doing? And I knew. I just knew at that moment that was it. I was done. I surrendered. I've been around AA long enough to know that this was my bottom. I could not take one more drink. And I personally believe that every single one of us hits the same bottom, regardless of the physical, emotional, mental circumstances surrounding it. It's that exact moment when the perception of pain from the next drink outweighs the perception of pleasure. And that's when I reached mine. And I'll never forget
looking
that.
In the mirror. You were looking in the mirror, right?
Yeah.
You looked in the mirror, and you saw the end.
And you know what? As long as I keep going to meetings, I'll never forget it. If I stop going to meetings, that memory may fade. I don't want it ever to fade because I don't want to remember that pain and that perception and that desire never to pick up another drink.
You'll never forget that.
Yeah.
You won't forget that. If you forget that, Let me tell you, if you forget that, you're not finished.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was April 5th, 1983, so a little over 31 years ago, and I still remember that moment. And here's where providence, coincidence, whatever you like to call it, came into play. I ran into a guy the next day that I drank with for 10 years, the only guy I ever knew that drank worse than I did. And he had gotten sober a couple of years earlier. And we have been really, really close friends. And I asked him to be my sponsor. He tentatively agreed. You know, he told me later he didn't think I'd make it through the weekend. And he was my sponsor for my first 18 years of sobriety. That was Gil, who was a great guy. And what he did was immediately get me involved in the steps, you know, from day one.
So, okay, now, did you ask him to be your sponsor, or did he ask you?
I asked him.
Okay.
I asked him. You know, he had tried to 12-step me many times before, had taken me to meetings, and, you know, we shared an apartment for a while when I was drinking and he was sober, and years later we tried to figure out who that was tougher on. But he was the guy, and he was the right guy for me, and you know, he was a lifesaver. And we got involved in the steps and the traditions, and we belonged to a big group. You know, it was over 400 members. There was over 25 meetings a week in that group. And I was going to meetings every day. You know, I was going to keep – I'm very anal, so I started to keep a list of all the meetings I go to and who the – what the topic was, where it was, da 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 da. You know, if they had spreadsheets back then, I would have put it on a spreadsheet. I was going to do that for 90 days because I wanted to be
a natural accountant. You're a natural bean counter.
Yeah. And so I wanted to make sure that I had my attendance records right in case anybody questioned me about, you know, my compliance with the AA program.
Yeah.
And I wanted,
like somebody out of the blue is going to say, can I see your documentation,
please? Exactly. And so I wound up keeping that record for over 3 years and well over 1,000 meetings, and I needed every single one of them, every single one of them. And strange things started to happen, you know. And the strange things that started to happen was I started to get better.
Tell me about the steps. Did you have any difficulties? How long did it take you to get through the steps? 1, 2, 3, usually you go. I think you could work the first 3 steps sitting at a traffic light. As a matter of fact, when we read how it works, steps 1 and 2 are part of the 3 propositions. So I don't see steps 1, 2, and 3 as being
a
big deal.
Yeah, everybody learns at their own pace. Everybody goes at their own pace. Some are sicker than others. Some are in the comprehend less than others. And I was pretty much an AA cadet. You know, I was in a step of the month club. And proceeded pretty much along that. I remember doing my 4th step in my 4th month, 5th step in the 5th month. And then I think they went pretty quickly after that.
Who directed the cadence? Did you as the sponsee, or did your sponsor direct the cadence of a step a month club?
I think it was kind of mutual, but I think he had more direction because it was kind of like he said, I think you're ready to do your 4th step. And then we started to discuss formats and this and that and the other thing, and it took me about a month to do it. But we talked about everything. You know, he didn't dictate, and I didn't but him. We just talked very openly, very honestly, and you know, I wanted to get well. He wanted me to get well, and we worked together towards that end. It was kind of very mutual. You know, it wasn't you know, one guy telling the other or one guy, you know, fighting the other. It was, you know, let's do what we need to do, because he wanted to get me where I should be, and I wanted to get there as well. So, you know,
he can only do what he knows. This is what he knew, and this is what he was passing along.
Right.
I get it. I understand that. The step a month club that was like that in Houston, I don't agree with that personally. It took me a lot longer than a step a month.
I don't agree with it. Yeah, no, I use that as kind of a joke. You know, it's just that that was the early pace it seemed to be going at. And, what it indicates is my willingness to go forward and his willingness to take me there.
Well, that was a general lay of the land several years ago. When I come to Houston, that was the deal, was a step a month, and that was it. So at the end of the year, you worked all 12 steps, and now you are in a position to sponsor because you have both. You had a year sobriety, you had just worked the steps, and that's how they pieced it together. But originally, you know, you did the whole shtick within a week. It was all done in a week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and just coincidentally, as I was getting better, things around me were getting better, and a lot of that was being in the right place at the right time. And another big part of that was it's amazing how well the mind works when it's free of alcohol. And during the first 5 years of my sobriety, number one, I broke every rule in the book, and I got married when I was 6 months sober.
That's part of the year deal. You know, that's not in the big book. That's not on page 94. That has nothing to do with anything. We just threw that stuff in. Don't do anything for your first year. Stand on your head in the corner.
Let me tell you an interesting story about that. Because I asked my sponsor, I said, look, I was engaged when I got into the program. Would it be a major change not to get married because I was already engaged? You know, what? Had a relationship. I was in a relationship. You know, should I? If I get out of it, that's a major change. And here's what he told me, and here's what I tell every one of my sponsees. He says, you're not looking for me to make a decision for you. You're looking for somebody to blame if the decision is wrong. Because the way,
right, exactly. You've already decided to do. You've already made your decision. You want somebody to confirm what you've decided. If they go against it, you're going to do it anyway. But just in the happen chance that they agree with you, see, now you have a corroboration of your agreement.
Yeah, no, but what he said was that the way you learn to grow in this program is to make your own decisions. Get as much feedback as you want from everybody you want to listen to. But you make your own decisions, and you accept responsibility.
Live with the consequence of that decision, whatever that looks like.
Well, and he said, and it's an important end. If the cornerstone of every decision you make is whether it's good or bad for your sobriety, you should be making the right decision.
Ah, that's good. I like that.
And I thought that was great, and that's what I tell every single guy that I sponsor. Anyway, getting back, because we got a long period of time to cover and a very short period of time to do it. And, you know, in my first 5 years, I'm not going to go into the details, but I became a multimillionaire. I had more money than I knew what to do with. And a big estate up in Armonk. And you name it. I had a chauffeur made, you know, office on Park Avenue, the whole bit. And as you can imagine, you know, what a success story. My group was trotting me out at least once a month to tell my story. And I would always end it with, and if I lost it all tomorrow, it wouldn't matter because these aren't the things that are important to me. What's important to me is family and love and service and helping another alcoholic, et cetera, et cetera. And then in my sixth year, I got to test that because I lost everything plus 10 times over.
Now you're in debt.
But I owed more money today than I could possibly repay in 10 lifetimes, and it was a disaster. It was a nightmare, and the fact of the matter is that I got to reaffirm what I had been saying. I said, "Wow, that was actually true what I was saying," because it was a pain in the ass, but it really didn't bother me that much. You know, I had other things in life.
I bet you're sorry you kept saying that. Yeah, I bet you kept saying that.
It was a lot easier to be spiritual when I had a couple $1 million in the bank.
I've been rich and I've been poor. I liked rich better. You know, they say that the best things in life are free. But at the current rate of inflation, free costs just so damn much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now
anyway,
let me kind of wrap this up here because for
31 years now, I've been living a life beyond my wildest dreams. And you know, I, I've You know, I've operated in 25 different countries. I've been the guest of prime ministers and kings, and I've climbed the corporate ladder almost as high as you can get for in Fortune 10 companies, and made a lot of money, lost a lot of money, and that's just a game, and that's how you keep score. But the whole time, I always stay very close to the program. I've always been sponsoring anywhere from 3 to 6 people. I've always gone to a lot of meetings. I still go to 6-7 meetings a week now, you know, at 31 years sober. And I do it for a couple of reasons. Number one, because I need to. Because I might not drink if I stop going to meetings, but I guarantee you I will start making changes for the worse. And every one of those changes for the worse will serve to deaden my spirit. And I won't be having any more spiritual awakenings. I'll be having spiritual deadenings. And therefore, you know, it's just a matter of time before I go crazy, and then probably pick up a drink. But and let me say this, because I got to get back to this. I told you about my family and the guys that I went to meetings with after that first meeting, the five of us. The first one to go was my brother Brian. He died in at the end of my first year of sobriety. Cirrhosis of the liver and hep C. And he was a kid that was 6'3", 250 pounds. He wound up 90 pounds, bleeding from every possible orifice. He was laying on his deathbed, and I could tell he wanted to get sober. He said, get me a room at St. Vincent's, which is the local rehab. And I knew he was he had hit his bottom, but it was too late for him. He couldn't go any further. In 94, my last remaining brother died of liver failure. You know, and I won't go into the whole story yet. So I lost my entire family to this disease. The five guys that went to meetings together, my brother went first. Stephen S. had about 4 years sober. He married a beautiful girl from the program. They had a beautiful daughter together. He found out he had AIDS, and he infected both his wife and his daughter. He went back out. He died on the street 6 months later. Little Danny, the third one, had 14 years sober. His brother died. He couldn't take it. He went back out. Took him 2 years. He came back in. He died a year later, sober, but he had a lot of struggles coming back. And the last one I told you was Dugan, who was the guy I saw in that Riviera. Well, Dugan was in and out, in and out, in and out. And I got a chance. I was up in New York a couple of years ago, and I got a chance to speak at the Larchmont Group anniversary. And Dugan wasn't there, but he was a member of that group, and somebody told me he had 17 years sobriety, and I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled. But what that shows me is there's such a fine line between being sober and being dead. You know, and it's really the luck of the drawer who makes it here, but then it's up to us to keep us here. You know, and I like to gamble, and I want to keep the odds in my favor, and the odds are in my favor as long as I go to a meeting every day. You know, because that's going to help me from rolling the dice again, because if I pick up a drink, I'm rolling the dice, and eventually I'm going to crap out. Now, what I didn't mention is that in my fourth year of sobriety, my son was born. I figured, look, we can break the genetic link here, because we're going to raise him with nothing but love and affection and positive self-esteem, da-da-da-da-da. Long story short, 17, he's in the program. And yeah, he had been shooting up, you know, he was shooting up on the rooftops of White Plains, drinking Robitussin, you name it, he was doing it. 17, he's going to be 20, he's 27 now, he's going to be 28 in August. New Year's Eve last year, I handed him a 10-year medallion. It doesn't get too much better than that. You know, that is a reward. That's the reward of being sober. Would he have been sober or gotten sober that early if he wasn't surrounded by people in recovery? I'm not sure. I don't think so. So, you know, one of the things that we can do, we may be the only copy of the big book somebody ever sees. So I feel there's an implied responsibility to carry the message of the program just in the way we live our lives, so that people can see and be attracted to that. Because we're a program of attraction, not promotion. And just let me end with the miracle of AA. And the miracle of AA is this. You know, because we're talking tonight and people are listening, there's going to be a lot of damage that's not going to be done to spouses, to families, to strangers. There's going to be less car accidents, less homicides, less abuses that are going to take place tonight. And you start multiplying that by the number of people and the number of meetings that not only in, you know, your listening audience, but in all of the United States and all of the world. And you think about all those people that touches and that affects for the good. And man, we're a movement for world peace. That's a miracle. That's a miracle. We're touching so many lives on a daily basis for the good. That it's almost beyond comprehension. I want to thank you guys again for giving me a chance, because this was really wonderful. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. You know, in the big book it says our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. What we have is a daily reprieve. But I'll put it to you this way. I've come to the point where what maintains itself of itself? Nothing really. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your recovery and then your sobriety becomes tentative. And all the people that I've seen that have gone through hell and high water and decided that a drink is going to make it better usually had let up on their action of service. They've let up. I call it restless laurelitis. It happens. I got 17 years. Sometimes it's easier not to do something. I'm not going to drink or if I'm not active. You see guys coming into the meetings once a year to pick up a medallion. You know, hey, that works for them. Who am I to say what? I think the important thing is the new guy gets the correct information when he walks through the doors. Mark Twain said, you learn exactly what you're supposed to do, and then you can change it in any way you wish. But I think it's important for the new man to see what the big book really has to say and gets the fundamentals of the program. But anyway, so tell us about your comedy club, your comedy schedule.
Yeah, I have a bucket list. So I had a bucket list because the last two things on it were – And those last two things were being a stand-up comic and writing a book. And what happened was in 2006, a buddy of mine and I were with our wives, and we went to a comedy club and see Jim Gaffigan, who was absolutely fantastic. And he said, you know, they're giving comedy workshops up at Side Splitters on Saturdays. So I said, well, let's go. And so we went, and we went every Saturday for 9 months for 3 hours. And we learned, you know, from some of the best, because every week whoever was headlining would come down and work with us, and the manager of the club was working with us, and we learned stage presence, mic control, how to write material, how to test out your material, you know, parsing of words, everything, you know. And you have to, and we started off doing open mics, and then both of us got hired as MCs. And then my claim to fame was I won the 2007 Sarasota Comedy Festival, so I started the feature, and I loved it. You know, but there's nothing worse, I think, for an alcoholic than to be, you know, when you're a stand-up comic, you're on that stage alone with all the spotlights on you, and you are the definite center of attention. Everybody's hanging on your every word. And
the center of you, the universe. Every alcoholic wants to be the center of the universe.
Oh, without a doubt. And that's why, you know what, you know, having done it for a number of years now, there's very few, almost every comedian I've met either needs to be in recovery or is in recovery. it's not a profession you go into if you're wrapped tight, you know? Yeah, you got a few screws loose, and I love performing. I don't do it anymore because it was a strain on the marriage and the family, and I mostly do. I'll do a fundraiser, a charity event, or a roast, or something like that, just for fun, just to keep my hand in it. But that was great, and I got to cross that off my list. I found out I could do it. I found out I could do it well, and it was something I really enjoyed. And then the last thing I did was write a book.
and got it published, and it, you know, it sold fairly well. And I'll never make a dime out of it, but it was something I felt I wanted to do because it was a book to help people in recovery or in need of recovery, you know, mostly in early recovery. It's kind of an AA for Dummies type of book. It's called Don't Drink and Go to Meetings by Dan F. You can get it on Amazon.com, but just let me read the back cover here, which says, I drank because of my problems until drinking became my biggest problem. I couldn't deal with the underlying problems until I put down the drink long enough to figure out what they were and how to address them. This is the story of my descent into hell and the journey back. It's a story of a fall from grace and a miraculous redemption. I want to share with you all the lessons I have learned in the hope that your journey will be made lighter. I want to share my burdens with you so they may be cut in half. I want to share my joys with you so they may be multiplied. And yeah, the goal is to help somebody along the path of recovery, either to continue that path or to find the path. You know, the first part of the book is my story, and so you can identify with it. The next part is the lessons I have learned since I've been sober, and then I go on to give my take on the steps, the traditions, and the promises. And it's just more for, you know, somebody else's perception, maybe something to give you an idea of a different way of looking at things. You know, somebody who's been around for a while versus hearing it from somebody who's relatively new. And it's been fulfilling, you know. And the greatest thing I ever hear is somebody tell me, hey, I read your book and it helped me. You know, or I gave your book to somebody who's now going to meetings. That's even better. So you know, I got to look for something new now, Joseph, to put on my bucket list.
Oh, well, that sounds like a high bottom. That sounds like a sober problem. Now, let's see, what else can I do? Let's see, wait a minute. You know, the other alternative is that you could just die, and then this way you leave completely fulfilled. You can think of it that way. Yeah, something
right,
I ran across.
I could probably wait for a while for that. Yeah. I'm in no rush.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. So the program has given you a tremendously full life. Although you know you're a smart guy, you know you have to be smart to survive this. I'll start in a meeting lately, and I got this recently. Is that what I've decided? AA was a group of dead people complaining that they were alive.
Okay. But you know something else, though, because you mentioned the being a smart guy, and you've heard it. I'm sure you've heard it said that alcoholics possess above average intelligence. Unfortunately, the only place I ever hear that is at AA meetings.
you don't hear people of the church going, yeah, those alcoholics, they're pretty smart people.
Yeah, exactly.
We're gonna pattern our lives over those alcoholics because they really know what's going on.
Find out what school he went to.
So, okay, now how do I get the book? You said it's at Amazon?
Amazon.com, yeah.
And
don't drink and go to meetings.
Which is interesting. We had mentioned that the Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, the AA's monthly meeting in print, that was their title, I think, in December.
Yeah.
Here at the Post Oak Club, the fellow started that. I don't know, about 10 years ago. He's dead now. It was like A, B, C. A, don't drink. B, go to meetings. C, repeat. A and B.
Right.
That was his deal. So there was a little furor about that on the Facebook arena about that, and some people are putting more energy into the meetings as recovery and not into working with sponsees. That seems to be a general lay of the land kind of deal. But we address that more on Rum Radio about sponsorship. You know, I believe sponsorship is the key. Bill W. working with Dr. Bob is how the thing started. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, keeping both of them sober. But, you know, the famous words, Dr. Bob didn't want to talk to Bill. He, you know, Bill was a unemployed stockbroker in 1935. Those were synonymous terms. And this guy's a doctor. And here's this unemployed stockbroker is going to want to see him about talking about his alcoholism. And Dr. Bob was kind of a private guy. And he had tried everything at that point. And this guy wants to talk to him. He says, look, I'll give him 15 minutes because I don't want to – he's wasting my time. So they meet at Henrietta Seiberling's house, which is interesting because he knew Seiberling. Frank Seiberling was called the Napoleon of Rubber. And Bill had known of him or met him during the halcyon days of Wall Street. So it was took him a lot to get overcome his humility of being, you know, ridiculed as an alcoholic to even call him up. He didn't know it was going to be Henrietta. But anyway, so Bob tells Bill, I'm going to give you 15. What can you tell me in 15 minutes that's going to keep me sober? I've been prayed over. I've been sliced and diced. More than a Christmas turkey. What are you going to tell me in 15 minutes that's going to keep me sober? And Bill turned around with the famous words, I'm not here to keep you sober. I'm here to keep me sober. And then they talked 6 hours after that. And basically that was the beginnings of AA. One drunk trying to stay sober by helping the next drunk. And we find it works. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail, and that's the beginning of the path. So thank you so much for coming on, Dan. It's been delightful.
Joseph and Harold, thank you both. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on.
Got any last words, Harold?
Well, I really have enjoyed hearing Dan's story, and I'm glad I'm sober today. I thank God for that, and I'm glad that you produced this program. It's really an honor to be part of it and hear these great stories. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you,
Joseph.
You're welcome, Harold. Well, in closing, I'd like to say this is Rum Radio. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages all through the world. Matter of fact, we're very popular in Nepal. Do you know why we're popular in Nepal? They like our yak. So if you're looking for sponsorship information, solid sponsorship information, we have other things on the website. It's a good read. It'll enliven your program. We direct it to all program information principles that really work. And you know what? There is a solution. But you got to remember, you got to take that first step. And remember, if you're looking for sponsorship, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.